right-wing nationalism in India to stand up for pluralism, and even have, in the last two election cycles, had a challenger who has been supported by some of the extreme elements because they didn't like my stance on pluralism.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, Congressmember O'Connor, Democratic Congressmember from California, Deputy Whip of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. Just recently voted no on the Pentagon budget, the sole voice in the Armed Service Committee. The vote was 58-1. That vote from Ro Khanna. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warren, Afterina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Honey Masood, and Sanji Lopez, our executive director, Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nagarik, Hugh Grand, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. To see our interviews and video and audio podcasts, you can go to democracynow.org and sign up there for a daily news digest. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio and the Jazz Society of Oregon are proud to present the 43rd Annual Cathedral Park Jazz Festival, Friday, July 14 through Sunday, July 16 at Cathedral Park in North Portland. Jazz, blues, soul, and Latin musicians will rock the park for 3 days. Curtis Salgado, Ural Thomas, Yak Attack, Chichito Valdez are just a few of the 15 bands performing this year. That's the 43rd Annual Cathedral Park Jazz Festival, Portland's longest-running community event, July 14, 15, and 16, under the St. John's Bridge in North Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is conducting a survey. Help us shape the types of news, public affairs, and music programming KBOO broadcasts in the future. Tell us how you listen to KBOO, and we'll use this feedback to help serve you better. The survey is anonymous. However, you will have an opportunity to provide your contact information to enter a drawing. 10 lucky winners will receive a $50 gift card. Complete the community survey before Sunday, July 16th. Go to our website at kboo.fm/survey23. That's kboo.fm/survey23. Thank you in advance for your time and your feedback. Stay tuned for KBOO's next strategic plan coming soon.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a hate crime surge in Oregon, which groups are seeing more reports of incidents. A victory for Oregon's houseless against a city that tried to enact a camping ban. And the real history behind the 4th of July may not be what you think. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, July 6, 2023. I am Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. Alarming data is coming out of the Oregon Department of Justice. Bias incidents and hate crimes are on the rise. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on the story.
A hotline at the Oregon Department of Justice has received nearly 6,000 reports of bias incidents and hate crimes over the last 3 years. That's according to a state report released this month. The report describes the acts as attempts to dehumanize, silence, and frighten people. Calls to the State Justice Department Bias Response Hotline increased 74% from 2021 to 2022. Last year, the hotline received 2,534 reports of bias incidents and crimes. The true number of events may be much higher, as underreporting is likely quite extensive. However, officials also note the hotline is still relatively new, and the increased number of calls may at least partly reflect the fact people are just discovering it. Personnel at the confidential hotline do not investigate each report, but callers may be connected to community resources and they may receive help making a police report. The report also says, quote, rhetoric about Jewish conspiracies, LGBTQIA2S+, and transgender rights increased in 2022 and became mainstream. This was reflected in increases in anti-Semitic, anti-sexual orientation, and anti-gender identity bias-motivated attacks, end quote. The document lists a number of key findings from the past year, including anti-Black African-American bias was the largest category, making up 1 in 4 of the reports. School bias incidents increased from 36 reports in 2020 to 408 last year. Reports of targeting sexual orientation were up 97%, and those involving gender identity up more than 150%. But anti-Asian reports decreased slightly last year compared to 2021, when such incidents rose as a result of rhetoric related to the COVID-19 pandemic. Fewer than 1/3 of people charged with a bias crime last year were convicted of any charge. Most defendants are sentenced to probation. The report noted that some prosecutors may be incorrectly classifying hateful behavior as mental health issues. The ACLU of Oregon, Sandy Chung, said she's concerned about what she sees as an increase in hateful rhetoric pushed by politicians. The Oregon Criminal Justice Commission, a state agency that helps develop criminal justice policy and which authored the report, outlined several recommendations, including continued outreach efforts by culturally specific community organizations and the State Department of Education, and creating a treatment program for bias crime perpetrators. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
A victory for houseless people in Oregon will stand. This comes in a fight over Grants Pass's attempt to stop people from sleeping in public places. The full Ninth Circuit decided to not revisit a 3-judge panel's ruling. This reaffirms that some Grants Pass ordinances aimed at homeless people violate the Eighth Amendment's cruel and unusual punishments clause. There are estimates that Republican-backed budget cuts could push 1 million more people into homelessness. Right now, there's no state, metro area, or county in the U.S. where a worker earning the minimum wage can afford a 2-bedroom rental home by working a standard 40-hour week. As Eric Galatis reports, now Congress is moving to cut housing assistance programs.
Colorado's minimum wage workers would have to work 94 hours per week to afford a modest 2-bedroom apartment, according to a new report. But even after a deal was struck to avoid a default on the nation's bills, Congress is still moving to cut roughly 22% from the U.S. Housing and Urban Development's budget. Kathy Alderman with the Colorado Coalition for the Homeless says cuts to affordable housing and rental assistance programs would be devastating for the nation's most vulnerable populations.
And if that happens, almost 1 million households that are currently receiving rental assistance could lose that rental assistance at a time when housing costs are increasing. And so it's likely that those households would fall into homelessness.
The GOP-controlled House of Representatives passed legislation in April calling for across-the-board cuts to non-military spending, which the Biden administration estimates would result in lost rental assistance for 10,000 Colorado families, including older adults, people with disabilities, and families with children. Families of color have long faced discriminatory housing policies dating to soldiers returning from World War II being denied down payments under the GI Bill and being denied mortgages in certain neighborhoods. Alderman says these families would also take the biggest hit if Congress succeeds in cutting housing assistance now.
Those households are going to be at much greater risk of falling into housing insecurity and particularly homelessness at a time when the Black and Native American populations are already disproportionately represented in the households experiencing homelessness.
The National Low Income Housing Coalition report ranked Colorado the 8th least affordable state in the nation for housing. Alderman says the best and most efficient use of tax dollars from HUD, Proposition 123 funding, and other recent affordable housing policies is to invest in solutions for the lowest income households with the greatest need.
Because if we don't stabilize those individuals, they will fall into the cycle of homelessness and they will draw down more resources because it is much more expensive to be in the cycle of homelessness than it is to stay stably housed.
This is Eric Galatis reporting.
Higher education advocates are speaking out because many students lost food benefits once pandemic-era provisions expired in June. As Suzanne Potter reports, work rules have toughened for students in the CalFresh program.
The pandemic-era exceptions that allowed many students access to CalFresh food benefits without having to work 20 hours a week expired in June, leaving many students in the lurch. CalFresh benefits range from $23 to $281 a month for a one-person household, and data showed 127,000 students were enrolled before the pandemic. Carrie Welton with the Institute for College Access and Success says the work requirements discourage CalFresh recipients from enrolling and make it much harder for low-income students to devote themselves to their studies.
The student rules were implemented in the 70s over fears that students who looked temporarily poor because they were enrolled in college but were still receiving support from their parents could get access to CalFresh. There's actually no data to suggest that that is the case.
In June, California Congressman Jimmy Gomez introduced the EATS Act of 2023, which would count college enrollment as satisfying the work requirement for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, which was renamed CalFresh in the Golden State. However, the bill faces an uphill battle with Republicans who recently made expansion of work requirements for food benefits a condition of raising the debt ceiling. Brandy Seminero is co-director of the CalFresh Outreach Higher Ed Project, a statewide initiative based at Cal State Chico. She says the government should make it easier for low-income students to afford the basics while in college.
We really see it as employment and training for students to attend college, expand their skills, and get additional training for future jobs to expand their income and contribute more to society as a whole. So we definitely see it as satisfying that requirement.
A study from Georgetown University found that people who earn an associate's degree make 25% more over their lifetimes compared with people who only have a high school diploma, and those with a bachelor's degree earn, on average, 75% more. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. I'm Suzanne Potter.
This is the week that many of us paid tribute to our nation's founding on July 4th. But do you know the real history behind it? For that, I asked historian and author Dr. Chris Nichols to tell us the difference between fact and fiction. Talk a bit about the history of Independence Day for a moment, reflecting back on that and why it's important to take a look back at that today and look at what's going on today.
Sure. Well, so one of my favorite fun facts as we think about celebrating July 4th is that actually the resolution for independence was passed unanimously by the Congress on July 2nd, 1776. July 4th is the ratifying day of the text when Congress issues the Declaration of Independence in several forms. And it's not until about July 19th that new so-called engrossed copies were ordered by Congress and then signed primarily on August 2nd. So whenever we say, you know, July 4th is this sacrosanct day, sure it is, and it's one that we all like celebrating, and I could talk a little bit about the history of celebrating it. But it's also important to note how often these days that we, you know, consider to be the really important markers of something are part of a longer process, right? You know, the Declaration itself was drafted over a long period of time and eventually resolved and all that stuff. So fun fact for those who are celebrating July 4th. All right, then another thing that's interesting about July 4th that I've thought about for years just studying U.S. history is that there's a spontaneous celebration that we know in the historical record in Philadelphia in 1777, but it's not really until after the War of 1812 when the U.S. beats back the British that it starts being celebrated more regularly. And kind of at the end of the lifespan of the founding generation, people like Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, who die, you know, famously die on July 4th itself, in the 1820s, do you start to see more celebrations of July 4th as a kind of really important Independence Day? And then thinking about it as a vacation day, as a federal holiday, you know, that's an important way of understanding how the nation state kind of constructs a day of celebration. So you don't really see that until after World War II, in fact. And that's when we get the kind of modern Independence Day that a lot of us think about. But even before that, one thing that I've noted, and I've used this in my classes, actually, it's really remarkable. You can find it in the Library of Congress website. There were interviews with people about how did they think about Independence Day during the Depression and the WPA interview process for writers going out. And very often people in small towns across the U.S. in the 1930s reported the most important celebration of the year in their small towns was July 4th. It wasn't Christmas. It wasn't, you know, whatever day you want to put in there, Incorporation of the City Day or, you know, graduation from a local school. And I think that is telling about how especially both small and big town Americans thought about and continue to think about their relationship to the state. We have a kind of big imagined celebratory sense of the state, you know, when we think about politics today, they're so rancorous, they're gross. A lot of people want to turn them off. There's something bigger than all of us. And those stories from the Depression era about how important July 4th was in bringing communities together can give us something, at least, however modest, to hold on to think about this is our shared sort of history. It's our shared community. And perhaps it, you know, gives us some ideals and some values to come together and believe in and celebrate, even across party differences or other kinds of differences.
Mm-hmm. And political differences now, too. Yeah. You hear with the 1619 Project people saying that our the country's true independence was really should be backdated to that. So what do you think of what do you make of those arguments? And I guess that sense of maybe we've kind of whitewashed our history a bit.
In the history of histories, historiography, as we call it, history is very often kind of whitewash and solidify a much more simplistic, triumphalist account for nation states. That's just a fact. But it doesn't mean we shouldn't push back against it. A good historian's answer to this good question of yours is that, you know, it goes way back. In the 19th century, African-American communities often said things like, even leading up to the Civil War, fellow African-Americans, free slaves, should celebrate Independence Day, but they should also use that as a day to mark the ways in which there were real inconsistencies between the ideals and principles of the Declaration and the practices of things like slavery, right? So this is a long-standing conversation in the U.S. It's not just the New York Times and the 1619 Project or that book. We've been encountering these discussions and debates for a long time. So when critics say this is highly political, we've never done this before, all of us historians say, wait, hold on. Actually, we've been having this conversation for a while. I actually think, you know, maybe this is the educator in me, but I think these kinds of days and anniversaries are very useful for us, again, to take some time to think about, well, hey, we're celebrating these ideals. What are they? Let's talk about them. You know, in my own family, my father's tradition was to read the Declaration of Independence, or at least pieces of it, every year on July 4th. And sometimes I thought that was hokey when I was a kid, but actually I've done that with some of my friends and talked about it and talked a little bit about the history. It's useful to think about, well, what are these things that they were arguing for? What is this document? You know, who is it intended for? Is it intended for us citizens? Is it intended for new migrants? Is it intended for the world? You know, and how does it change kind of the interpretation over time? And you see that in criticisms as well as kind of triumphalist accounts. And I think we could see that in our everyday lives if people would pause to think a little bit about what was really being declared when the U.S. aimed to throw off the shackles of the British monarchy. What were the kinds of principles enshrined there as fundamental rights that then become the Constitution? And what were the things that were omitted in thinking about slavery, for instance, or thinking about religion, for instance, as two really important markers of change over time and values?
What's your favorite thing to do on Independence Day as a historian?
Yeah. Oh, as a historian. Well,
as a human.
As a human being. Yeah. It's probably the very good old-fashioned grilling burgers, the smell of things grilling. I can't get that out of my mind or my sensory input, output. I think it's also gathering with friends and family. Like, I mean, I think it's just a great excuse to get together, even if you're an arch critic of whoever's in office or whatever the U.S. is doing. You know, it's a great time to just take a pause, have a long weekend, hang out, see people. And as such, you know, I find that to be fitting in a way for the kind of values that we see then in the Declaration, that sort of thing. In other words, you know, as a historian, celebrating and seeing family and grilling things and indulging in food and drink and stuff that you maybe don't usually do, that seems like the kind of freedoms and privileges that are pretty remarkable in world history that Americans get to enjoy. Even the worst off of most Americans can enjoy some of those things. And that's a really impressive, amazing thing that we shouldn't take for granted.
Absolutely. Well, thank you. That was great.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I firmly believe all that.
Good. That's good. It sounds like you have some wonderful
parties. What's your favorite thing to do?
You know, what's magical? It's still the fireworks. It's just magical to me, going and see the fireworks. Yeah, the cooking and all that. The picnicking, hanging out with friends, family. Yeah. That's great, too. But there's something magical about 4th of July fireworks. And I used to be in parades with my cousins when we were kids, and we would dress up for the costume parade for, you know, that kind of. So it's like it's very entrenched in that whole family cultural thing.
It's just in your psyche that thing. It's got to be like parade and fireworks. You know, I think because I grew up in New York City, the fireworks are this huge spectacle, of course, but they're much easier seen on TV. Like the throngs of people, you know, out on the FDR drive or are just enormous numbers and a little off-putting to a small child, no matter how much they like the fireworks. You know, I think, you know, one thing that's very quintessentially American, which I was referring to with the WPA thing, is the ways in which small towns celebrate July 4th. I mean, as I've lived more and more places in the U.S., the more I've seen the kind of interesting local traditions mixed with this kind of national thing. So you have the fireworks, but you have local pageantry and dressing up in very different ways or different local histories, different communities coming together. That's pretty neat.
Dr. Chris Nichols is a historian, author, and professor at The Ohio State University. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather, clear to partly cloudy, down to 57. Tomorrow's weather, morning clouds give way to mostly sunny skies, a high near 85. Today in history, on this date in 1957, Althea Gibson became the first African-American to win Wimbledon. The quote of the day is from Althea Gibson, "Being a champion is all well and good, but you can't eat a crown." In Nevada, the governor's veto of the HOPE Act is denying care for pregnant women and those younger than 17. As Alex Gonzalez reports, it's thought to especially impact the state's Latino population, about 30% of the people living in Nevada.
Senate Bill 419 was one of many bills vetoed by Nevada Governor Joe Lombardo. The bill, also known as the HOPE Act, would have expanded Medicaid eligibility to undocumented immigrants in the Silver State. Nevada Senator Fabian Doñate says the measure received bipartisan support and was worked on with the governor's office. The HOPE Act would have provided health care coverage to pregnant women and children younger than 17 who don't qualify for Medicaid because of their immigration status.
It's our obligation to make sure that they are protected and that they receive prenatal services. That's the reason why we introduced the bill. They're not going to leave.
Doñate says he'd like the governor and the Latino caucus to continue to partner on legislation, as he says was done this last session, to pass bills that'll help the Latino community. In his veto letter, Lombardo says the state's Division of Healthcare Financing and Policy had insufficient resources to implement the measure. Executive Director of Make the Road Nevada, Leo Murieta, says Lombardo's on the wrong side of history and adds the governor played politics with the lives and futures of immigrant families. He adds the more than 500 Nevadans the group mobilized to help push the proposal forward are devastated.
It's the HOPE Act. It was supposed to bring hope. It inspired hope that their families could be protected, that when their families need prenatal care, that they won't have to risk their lives to bring children into this world.
Murieta says they're planning to come back stronger in 2025 and continue fighting to get the measure passed. I'm Alex Gonzalez.
Advocates react to recent controversial Supreme Court rulings. The Department of Housing and Urban Development faces budget cuts. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2023 Talks.
It feels very much like this can and will be the start of something that enables more discrimination and more prejudice against anyone associated with the LGBTQ plus community.
After the U.S. Supreme Court ruled businesses providing what they called expressive goods and services can pick and choose who they want to work with, John Hilton, president and executive director of the nonprofit queer news outlet Lookout, worries about the impacts of the ruling. Christian web designer Lori Smith refused to create websites for same-sex weddings because of her religious beliefs, which the court decided was her First Amendment right. Hilton says it's not a liberal or conservative issue. Rather, it is based in what he describes as religious-inspired bigotry versus individuality. Meanwhile, education advocates are still reeling from the Supreme Court's ruling on affirmative action. Originally passed a year after the Civil Rights Act of 1964, public opinion has shifted. Recent polls found Americans of different races were both in favor and not as in favor of the policy as they once were. Rosemary Rivera with Citizen Action of New York says affirmative action was more of a safety blanket for minority students getting into colleges than a tool to gain admission. Though it's a different world since affirmative action first came to be, Rivera says racism hasn't changed, making programs like affirmative action even more necessary.
Until racism is eradicated in our policies, institutional racism is eradicated, then yes, I'd still believe that we are going to need policies that help Black, Brown, and low-income people actually thrive.
Congress is considering cutting 22% of the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development's budget. In a letter to the Committee on Appropriations, HUD Secretary Marsha L. Fudge said the cuts would be the most devastating impacts in the department's history and would make it impossible to stave off mass evictions. Kathy Alderman with the Colorado Coalition for the Homeless says the cuts would harm the most vulnerable populations.
And if that happens, almost 1 million households that are currently receiving rental assistance could lose that rental assistance at a time when housing costs are increasing. And so it's likely that those households would fall into homelessness.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira.
Archibald wants her job back as head of the First Nations Assembly. Rapid City Police respond to the NDN Collective July 4th march. And Iditarod winner Reddington will be the keynote speaker at the AFN convention. With these stories and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with the National Native News.
The ousted leader of Canada's Assembly of First Nations says she wants her job back. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, Roseanne Archibald is calling on her supporters to tell their chiefs and councils to reinstate her.
Archibald was voted out as national chief of the AFN last week. That came after a year of controversy over her leadership, and in part over allegations related to complaints that AFN staff had filed against her. She was the first woman to serve in the role of national chief of the organization and was in the job for just over 2 years. 70% of the chiefs and council members voted her out of the job. But Archibald says the human rights complaints and investigation against her were a distraction because she had made allegations of corruption within the AFN and was calling for a forensic audit.
I want to be reinstated because I have a sacred responsibility that I have to fulfill. And there has to be ceremony before I begin that journey and at the end. And what the chiefs did on June 28th is they ignored that ceremony. They ignored our sacred ways. And they just went ahead and did one of the most violent acts against an Indigenous First Nation woman leader ever in a national kind of way, in a world stage kind of way. And that is not acceptable.
Archibald is a Cree leader from Ontario who first entered the political arena in 1989 as a youth activist. She became her community's youngest and first female chief a year later. In 2000, she led a blockade and hunger strike against logging on her First Nations territory. In 2021, she became the AFN's first woman national chief, pledging to clean up the organization. She is now also the first national chief officially voted out of office. But chiefs who voted against her said they took the action not because of her gender, but because it had everything to do with her actions, competence, and performance. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Native people held a march on 4th of July, closing down a downtown street in Rapid City, focused on policing of the local Native community. Now police are responding, as South Dakota Public Broadcasting's CJ Keene reports.
The protest was organized by Rapid City-based Native advocacy group Indian Collective. Sunny Red Bear is a local organizer with the group who gave a list of demands at a press conference before the march.
Number one is end the killing of Indigenous people by the police. Two, an immediate civil rights inquiry into the Rapid City Police Department and Pennington County Sheriff's Office. Three, release of all body camera footage. Four, the removal of school resource officers. Five, rescind SB4. Six, defund the police and increase community-controlled education programming and funding. And seven, third-party investigations of police and sheriff's office.
SB4 is a South Dakota law that allows the court system to recommend repeat juvenile offenders to the State Department of Corrections. In response, RCPD spokesperson Brendan Medina focused on the scope of these issues.
We've heard their demands loud and clear, and the reality is it's going to take more agencies than just the Rapid City Police Department and the Pennington County Sheriff's Office to come to the table. So, we're willing to be at that table moving forward, but it's going to take more than just us.
The Pennington County Sheriff's Office did not return request for comment. For National Native News in Rapid City, I'm CJ Keene.
The Alaska Federation of Natives Convention will return to Anchorage this fall, highlighting subsistence and the Alaska Native cultural connection to the land. AFN is the state's largest convention, drawing in people from across the state. Economists say it pumps millions of dollars into the Anchorage economy, as people typically extend their stay to attend other meetings as well as the Elders and Youth Conference. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
One of the most noteworthy decisions issued by the U.S. Supreme Court this term will bring big changes in how race is viewed in college admissions. The decision ends a longtime policy known as affirmative action.
Voices representing Native American college students are weighing in on that outcome. Mike Moen has more.
Advocates for underrepresented college students continue to assess the fallout from last week's U.S. Supreme Court decision dealing with affirmative action. That includes voices within the Native American higher education community. In a major ruling, the court's conservative majority largely overturned a decades of precedent that prompted colleges and universities to consider a prospective student's race in trying to maintain diverse campuses. Cheryl Crazy Bull of the American Indian College Fund says Natives technically aren't considered a race because of their tribal citizenship, but she says while it was limited, Indigenous students did benefit from affirmative action.
We have been able to go to law school, go to medical school, get into business school, all of those kinds of things, because the broad implications of affirmative action are rooted in the value of that diversity.
She sees this as an opportunity for colleges and universities to expand their outreach into Native communities. Schools around the country have issued statements saying they remain committed to campus diversity after the court's decision. When looking at 2020 data, the Post-Secondary National Policy Institute says 22% of the college-aged Native American population were enrolled in schools, compared with 40% of the overall population. And Crazy Bull says groups such as hers also hope the decision doesn't discourage Indigenous students from applying to mainstream campuses. She says allies need to reassure these individuals that there is a place for them at these schools, and that administrators not only boost their recruitment, but make the students feel welcome once they get there.
I also think institutions need to take proactive steps to ensure that students are visible on campuses, that they have the support systems in place.
The same data from the PNPI show that since 2010, Native American enrollment at U.S. colleges has declined by nearly 40%. Other groups joining the American Indian College Fund in its response include the American Indian Science and Engineering Society, Cobell Scholarship Program, and the Native Forward Scholars Fund. Mike Moen, Prairie News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, July 6, 2020.